Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hey everyone, you're listening to Commons and Chronicles. You may have heard on my end of the year episode that this is the final episode, or that was the final episode, that I was not going to be doing this show anymore. And that's still true, but in this episode I want to focus on some implementations of the things that we've talked about over the course of this series. And by that I mean that there's, when you talk about stuff that has fallen into the public domain, stuff that is that's so old that no one care, or so forgotten that no one cares about it anymore, so hey, you can pick it up and run with it. That's not a huge seller, right? That doesn't sell you on the content necessarily. Now it might. I mean, some stuff is just so good that you kind of see the intrinsic value in the thing. But I think that presenting something in that way sometimes does make people question whether it has intrinsic value or not. And strangely, the way that modern human brains work, I think, sometimes you don't see the value in something until you see the price tag. So I am largely talking about things with a price tag attached. I'm not necessarily encouraging you to purchase any of these things. I'm simply pointing to them as interesting examples of ways that things have been adopted from the past because they are in the past. Now, I've mentioned before Modiphius Entertainment, and they have a Conan the Barbarian role-playing game, which I've never actually played. I think I downloaded their quick start guide that they published for Free RPG Day, and I haven't had the chance to actually play it at all, so I don't know a whole lot about it, and I haven't read the rule book, so I don't know what kind of additional content they're generating within the Conan universe and so on. Now, I do happen to know that they have an official license from Robert E. Howard's estate, or from someone who has adopted Robert E. Howard's likeness and name and is selling quote-unquote official licenses. As far as I can tell, all that actually means is that two people, Jeffrey Shanks and Patrice Lunette, are experts in Robert E. Howard's universe and are offering sort of approval, stamps of approval for people or for organizations that stay true, again, sort of quotes around all of this, to the originals. I don't know whether that has value or not. I mean, it sounds less like a license than sort of an association that sort of gives an approving nod to something, and that's fine. To a Robert E. Howard purist, maybe that matters. To a Conan purist, maybe that matters. I don't know how well anyone can divine how Robert E. Howard would feel about the expanded universe of Conan that happened after his death. I don't know that anyone can know that, so it's a little bit weird. But either way, it is benefiting hugely from the public domain content of Robert E. Howard's body of work. And it's a role-playing game. It is something that you can go and purchase and play and benefit from all of the whatever expansion they've done to the universe, to the codification of playing a game in that world. It's something that exists. But what really made me think to pursue this path of mental exercise is a digital comic series that I think I've mentioned on a different show at some point. But you may not have heard that show by any means, and even if you have, I'm going to mention it again now because I've spent a lot more time with these volumes than I had at that point. But there's a company out there called Dynamite, and you can go to their website, dynamite.com. That's D-Y-N-A-M-I-T-E, Dynamite Comics. And they apparently, from what I can tell, specialize in properties in external properties. So as far as I know, and there could be some exceptions to this, but as far as I can tell, they don't have properties of their own. They do comics for characters and storylines that don't originate from Dynamite. So, for instance, they have a comic series called Army of Darkness after the Army of Darkness movie from the Evil Dead series. They've got a series for Vampirella and for Elvira and for Battlestar Galactica, Xena, Princess Warrior, Sherlock Holmes. These are names you're going to recognize no matter what division of geek culture you're into. And the one that I wanted to mention specifically here that makes sense to talk about would be the Deja Thoris series. Now, I got a big dump of Deja Thoris comics from a Humble Bundle that I purchased. There were about 12 issues, I think, each about 23 pages long. I don't tend to go to physical comic book stores. It's just not something that I have built into my routine. And frankly, I don't have a physical comic book store within an hour's drive of me right now. But the Deja Thoris comic book series has turned out to be really, really enjoyable and really quite fascinating from lots of different angles. I mean, it's no secret, and it doesn't take a literary scholar or a historian to see that the original John Carter novels don't really revel in the female characters being heroes themselves. They are typically, even when they are very sort of strong characters themselves, they end up in situations where they require rescue. And it's kind of to be expected from a book that was written in 1915, probably. That's probably something that is realistically something that you would expect to see. And indeed, that's what you see in all the John Carter books. Like I said in the final episode, I think Chessmen of Mars probably has the strongest character, and she is Tara, the daughter of John Carter, and she's probably the strongest female character of the whole series. And even she ends up about midway through the book playing very much just kind of second fiddle to the suitor who is pursuing her, who's trying to rescue and also pursue her romantically. So it's a little bit painful if you're a modern reader, whether you're, you know, you could be the most sort of conservative modern reader, and I think it's still kind of, you'd still have to ask, why doesn't this person just do this instead of just sitting around waiting to be rescued? It's not as bad in Chessmen as it is in the other earlier books, but it's still pretty blatant that these characters just aren't really everything that they could be in the interest of ensuring that the male lead is going to has a goal for the book. And I'm not saying that I'm not making a judgment call about the books based on that by any means. I love the books. I'm just saying for a modern reader, it does kind of seem a little bit foreign. In the Deja Thoris comics, it's completely revisionist. It takes that obvious truth about the original content and completely turns it on its head, and just makes Deja Thoris the main character of her own story. I will admit that it's a little bit odd to have John Carter in this series at all. I'm not entirely sure why they had John Carter here, because it feels like what would have made a lot more sense in the timeline is to have John Carter back on Earth at this time and make this be the Deja Thoris that we get to experience after John Carter has saved the environment of Mars, he's rebooted the environment machine at the pole and has been whisked back to Earth for what I think he's gone for 10 years or something, so or 20 years, something like that, and it would just make more sense for Deja Thoris to be on her own for the comic series. And the character of John Carter does almost nothing during the whole series, which, I mean, I have no problem with that. I have no allegiance to John Carter. I've often felt that he is the weakest character in the John Carter series, or the least interesting character in the John Carter series anyway. But I could have seen this series making a lot more sense as Deja Thoris, maybe Tarkus, and maybe her son, possibly. I mean, he would still be probably growing up, but for the timeline, it would just make more sense. But for whatever reason, they keep John Carter in the story, and he just kind of He's kind of an advisor to Deja Thoris, and he just kind of wanders around and says, "Let's kill stuff," and she says, "No, let's not." So it's a bizarre sort of. It seems particularly odd. It seems as odd for him to be in this story as it seems in the original book for Deja Thoris to stop being an interesting character once they meet. But that aside, the series is really is quite good. I mean, it's not the best comics I've ever read. There are some storytelling techniques that they endeavor to use that I still don't quite understand what they were going for. The very first scene, I think, in the very first issue has, I think it's using flashbacks or something, and I was never super clear about when we were flashing back to or flashing forward to. It was very, very confusing. That said, the story is fine. It's about the uneasy peace between the green and the red Martians. It's 12 issues, 23 pages long, and it's really enjoyable, and it's a great example of how a rich and detailed and exciting world like Barsoom, as written down by Edgar Rice Burroughs way back in 1915, can be adopted and developed further for a modern reader. I mean, this series very much, and I once again apologize for drawing so many parallels from between Barsoom and Tatooine, but I kind of have to. But this series makes Deja Thoris into kind of the Princess Leia from Jabba's palace. It makes, in every sense of what Princess Leia was during that time, it adopts that and puts it into Deja Thoris. And now, arguably, there are lots of parallels existing already, so I feel like this is modern comics borrowing from something that borrowed from the source of the comic itself. That said, if you're looking for that style of swashbuckling sci-fi adventure in a clothing-optional setting, then this comic series is exactly what you're looking for. Now, there's a whole other series about Deja Thoris. So the one that I got from Humble Bundle is but one entry into a couple of different stories that they have with her. The series that I'm specifically referring to is called Deja Thoris and the Green Men of Mars. But there are other books that you can get. There's Deja Thoris, Soldier of Memory. There's Deja Thoris and the White Apes of Mars. Couple of different series, and even an art book, a hardcover book about the art of Deja Thoris and Barsoom. And they delve further into the world. They don't stop with Deja Thoris. They have a Warlord of Mars series that covers Deja Thoris before John Carter arrives on Barsoom. They have a John Carter series, and then they even have a series called, I think, Worldscape, which happens to incorporate at least Tars Tarkas, if not John Carter as well. So they play around with these properties in really, really exciting ways that you probably wouldn't see coming. So it's worth checking out, if only to see how skillfully and how richly existing properties can be adapted for, like I say, a modern audience, or just adapted for fun. Because that's really what it boils down to in the end, is that we've got these rich cultural artifacts that, if they're not used, are going to fade away. And I think that's the real potential crime here, is that there are all this work that someone has put into creating a universe of fiction, and because of a copyright restriction, no one else can build on it and keep it growing. And that sort of just that forces that work into stasis. And nobody likes that. Nobody wants that. I mean, it's nice to have that artifact. It's nice to have that thing as it was then, so that we can look at it and experience it and think, oh, how interesting it is how people used to think that back then, or how funny it is that this would have seemed exciting to them at that time, or wow, that's really cool. We should use that. And we should be able to draw upon those ideas. And it's really encouraging when you see things like Dynamite Comics or Modiphius, when they're reaching into that rich world of potential and actually using those ideas and bringing them forward and putting new ideas into them. It's a lot of fun. I think one of the confusing things about Creative Commons for a lot of people, or public domain for that matter, or shared culture at all, is the question of canon. And how can you have a Deja Thoris who is one way in the book and then is a completely different character in a comic series? Or how can you have a Conan who is from the north in this story, but doesn't really act like a barbarian in this later story, or says that he's from a different land in this book later on. Whatever the problem is, we catch them all the time. They exist everywhere, these little breaches of canon. I mean, it's a big business to stay to manage canon, and some people really, really enjoy tracking that and resolving that, and that's part of the enjoyment for some people. For other people, canon can be explained, and this is the camp that I fall into, by the same kind of magical explanation as we provide for the multiverse. Infinite possibilities, infinite versions of the same characters or the same stories, because ultimately, especially in fiction, you can layer these things on top of each other, and two different conflicting things can be stated in two different books. And it doesn't matter, because in science fiction and in fantasy more and more, the idea of a timeline being singular and linear is just not a thing. To say nothing of how many different versions of the same story we ourselves tell throughout our own lifetime. So there's really a lot more flexibility in, I think, general canon than some people prefer to allow for. And it can be difficult, because if you exist in one timeline and you're trying to organize a bunch of things from a different timeline and make them all fit into one layer, yeah, that can be difficult. But I just kind of feel like, given a little bit of fiction, a little bit of allowance, you can make all of those things sort of live happily together. And such is the case for certainly a lot of these old science fiction properties, or all these old or fantasy properties that people are iterating on. I mean, Robert E. Howard first published the Conan stories in 1932-ish. And I think in 1955, there was a big collection of the stories that I guess brought them back into public awareness. And then by the 1960s, it was completely expected that people would be writing stories in that universe. Paul Anderson, Harry Turtledove, L. Sprague de Camp, Robert Jordan, a bunch of different authors were writing stuff about Conan in the Conan universe, and it was more or less accepted as, I guess, Conan canon. And that's exciting, and that's the reason we still have Conan today. So it's important. We should support the commons, we should support public domain, we should support the concept that fictional ideas are meant to be riffed on. They're meant to be iterated upon. It's a healthy thing to do. It's part of preservation. It's a part of continuing a culture well beyond someone's life or death, or when they've stopped creating something because they're bored with it, they're done with it. Those ideas ought to be continued. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your holidays, whether you have time off or whether you're working or whatever you may be doing. Settle down at some point, hunt down the descendants of all of your favorite stories, and see what other people have done with them. I think you'll enjoy it. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.